Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, July 17, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Telephone Conference Call on Who Judges Who is a Judge. My name is Christian Corgan and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts. The first is Professor Kristen E. Hickman, who is the Harlan Albert Rogers Professor in Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. And the second is Professor Tuan Samahan, who is a Professor of Law at Villanova University School of Law. More complete bios for both of our experts were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. And without any further ado, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Professor Samahan, who's going to get us started. And Professor Samahan, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. I'm Tuan Samahan, and I served as a part of a team as pro bono counsel for the taxpayers, the Koretskys, and their appeal from the United States Tax Court to the D.C. Circuit in the case Koretsky versus Commissioner. And the issue that was presented to the D.C. Circuit was whether a tax court proceeding, when held by judges who are subject to presidential removal for malfeasance, inefficiency, and neglect of duty, is constitutionally tainted such that when challenged, that proceeding may be vacated and remanded for new proceedings before judges not subject to that removal power. So by statute, the president enjoys a removal power over the tax court judges. To be sure, it is a qualified removal power for malfeasance, inefficiency, and neglect of duty. Those terms have been interpreted verbatim in another case, Bauscher versus Sinar, which explained that although these terms appeared by to be somewhat qualified, that they nonetheless create a here and now subservience of the removable officer to the removing officer, and that they were conceivably very broad grounds that could stand in for any number of actual or perceived transgressions. And this means, therefore, that the removal power doesn't actually ever need to be exercised to be effective. There is an interorum effect, a self-disciplining that occurs when one labors under such a removal power because of the presumed need to please the removing officer. So, again, the removal power might on occasion be used to, if you will, sort of display a head on a pike at the outskirts of the city. But it's understood that this power exists in the background, and so it has a disciplining interim effect without actually needing to be used. Well, this holding from Bauscher versus Sinar concerning the importance of the removal power is mixed, interestingly, with the Freitag versus Commissioner opinion. In that case, it was explained that the tax court exercises a portion of the judicial power of the United States. And so the interesting question that is raised is if the president, being an executive officer, has a power, albeit qualified, to remove officers who exercise a portion of the judicial power of the United States, does this not constitute a violation of the separation of powers? And as the D.C. Circuit addressed the question in its Koretsky opinion, the court chose to focus on this second point, on what is the nature of the power exercised by the United States Tax Court. And I think somewhat interestingly, although peculiarly, the court seems to have taken the dissenting rationale approach, or rather the separately concurring approach in the Freitag case rather than the majority approach. In Freitag, the court was confronted with an accepting clause challenge. The question was whether the special trial judges of the United States Tax Court could be constitutionally appointed by the chief judge of the U.S. Tax Court. And in order for that to occur, the chief judge of the U.S. Tax Court had to either be a head of an executive department, or else had to be considered a part of the courts of law. And in trying to reach that determination, Justice Blackmun, who ultimately concluded that the chief judge of the U.S. tax court was a part of the courts of law, he looked at the nature of the functions exercised by the tax court. In so doing, he examined what is it that is done by the tax court, and he compared the functions of the tax court to that of a United States district court. And under this functional analysis, the court concluded that the tax court exercised judicial rather than executive, legislative, or administrative power. Indeed, the court clarified that the court exercises a portion of the judicial power of the United States. So it didn't say that it was exercising executive power in a quasi-judicial mode, but that it was actually exercising a portion of the judicial power of the United States. In contrast to this functional approach, Justice Scalia, concurring separately for four justices, concluded that the performance of adjudicatory functions by a federal officer really is not the sine qua non of the exercise of the judicial power of the United States, that really adjudication is merely a mode of decision-making, and that actors in the executive branch could use this mode of decision-making without the power thereby becoming an exercise of the judicial power of the United States. And I think Justice Scalia's insight is an important one, and it's insightful if it's treated as merely necessary and not a sufficient condition with some further requirement to satisfy the gap. Nonetheless, it remains that Freitag versus Commissioner concluded that one looks at the function, and in assessing whether or not judicial power was at stake, the Freitag majority said that we're going to define the constitutional status of the tax court and its role in the constitutional scheme, and it did say that the power that was exercised was, quote, judicial rather than executive, legislative, or administrative. Well, in order to resolve the conundrum that was presented to the D.C. Circuit had determined that it was going to reach the merits, that there was a redressable injury here, that there was a real live case or controversy, and that the IRS's arguments concerning forfeiture and consent did not carry the day. The court offered a clause-bound interpretation of what Freitag had said. The court recharacterized Freitag as saying that a tribunal can be considered a court of law for purposes of the appointments clause, notwithstanding that its officers may be removed by the president. And so on this take, the Koretsky court concluded that the power that is exercised by the United States tax court is executive power, not judicial power, and that therefore, even with a broad removal power, that this would be consistent with the separation of powers because an executive officer has removal power over executive officers. So the interesting upshot of the opinion is that the D.C. Circuit's approach in Koretsky may actually embolden the president to use his removal power in the context of the tax court because, as the Koretsky opinion put it, if a president were someday to exercise removal authority would be entirely consistent with the separation of powers. So with that summary of the argument and the summary of the decision, I just want to add my plug for the idea of the United States Tax Court being an entity that not be under the thumb of the tax enforcer in chief. That is that the IRS have something between it and the taxpayers as an independent bulwark to protect taxpayers and the administration of tax law. There is a concern that that there may be executive bias towards certain types of taxpayers and certain sorts of taxpayer claims that would tilt the playing field in favor of the tax collector and against the taxpayer. And regrettably, rather than severing the removal power and allowing the tax court to serve as a better bulwark for the taxpayer, I think that this decision has now potentially moved the tax court more firmly into the president's orbit. So that said, I'll leave comments here for Professor Hickman for her criticism and thoughts on the case.
Thanks, Tuan. I have no real connection with this case whatsoever beyond my academic interest in tax and administrative law issues, which of course includes related separation of powers questions. I would note that the courts have always struggled, I would say, with how to characterize governmental entities that do not fit neatly into one or another of the three traditional branches of government recognized by the Constitution. But in this case, and that includes the tax court, which is just one of these bodies that is a little bit of an odd duck. In this case, I think it's important to recognize that what we're talking about is a provision of the Internal Revenue Code saying that judges of the tax court may be removed by the president after notice and opportunity for public hearing for efficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, but for no other cause. In other words, a fairly traditional four-cause removal restriction or four-cause restriction on any power of the president that the president might have to remove the particular officer of the United States. Now, in this case, we've got the Koretskys arguing that this four-cause restriction on the president's ability to remove tax court judges caused the judges to be biased against taxpayers in their rulings because the tax court judges feared removal by the president. I'm not exactly sure how deciding in favor of the taxpayers would in any sense qualify for the inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office that would even give the president the ability to remove tax court judges in the first place. But leaving that aside, for decades, the Supreme Court and nearly everyone else has regarded statutory four-cause removal provisions as protecting officers of the United States from the negative consequences of presidential and political influence. This has been the fundamental premise of removal power cases starting almost 100 years ago with Myers versus United States and Humphrey's executor, all the way through the Free Enterprise Fund case from a few terms back, in which the Supreme Court struck down a four-cause removal provision from the part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that created the Public Accounting, Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. The conventional wisdom of this entire line of jurisprudence is that Congress enacts four-cause removal provisions in the first place to insulate government officers from presidential and political influence. So the separation of powers argument in removal power cases has always been over whether or not Congress has impermissibly intruded upon the executive power by limiting the president's ability to fire officers of the United States through four-cause removal restrictions. If the entire animating principle of removal power jurisprudence is that four-cause removal provisions protect government officials from presidential and political influence, then I don't think the D.C. Circuit was ever going to turn that understanding on its head by finding that tax court judges are impermissibly biased by a four-cause removal provision. Still, the D.C. Circuit's opinion took what I think is a creative argument, at least, and turned it into an opportunity to say something that I find at least academically interesting about the tax court and separation of powers principles, but that I don't think is going to be tremendously consequential in the future. Regarding the tax court, in Freitag, as Tuan said, that was an appointment power case. The Supreme Court divided 5-4 over whether the tax court was a court of law that exercises the judicial power or a department that exercises executive power, with the chief judge serving as the head of that department. The majority of the Supreme Court in Freitag characterized the tax court as a court of law exercising judicial power for purposes of the Appointments Clause. Justice Scalia wrote a concurring opinion in Freitag in which he said that the only Article III courts can exercise the judicial power, and that instead the tax court was a department for purposes of the Appointments Clause. Now, almost 25 years later, in Koretsky, the D.C. Circuit is maintaining that the tax court does not exercise the judicial power of the United States under Article III of the Constitution, but instead exercises the inherently executive power to use adjudication to resolve certain public rights issues. And the D.C. Circuit's reasoning, as Twan says, is much more consistent with Justice Scalia's concurrence in Freitag than the Supreme Court's majority opinion in that case. Hence, the Koretsky Court had to distinguish Freitag, and it did so in two ways. First, by saying that Freitag concerned the Appointments Clause rather than the President's removal power, and second, by saying that the Freitag majority used the phrase judicial power in an enlarged sense for purposes of the Appointments Clause rather than the more limited Article III variety. I think, truly, that both of the D.C. Circuit's ways of distinguishing Koretsky from Freitag are at least a bit of an analytical stretch. At the same time, probably because these sorts of cases don't come around all that often, and because times and justices or judges change, and the Supreme Court is not known for its analytical consistency regarding either the Appointments Clause or the removal power in any event. My Supreme Court prognostication skills aren't especially robust, but I don't really see the Supreme Court granting cert in this case to correct the D.C. Circuit's characterization, and I'm not really all that concerned that the D.C. Circuit's characterization of the President's removal power over tax court judges or its discussion of executive power or judicial power with respect to the tax court in the context of the removal power is going to have all that much practical significance going forward. The real debate, it seems to me, is over whether the D.C. Circuit's characterization of the tax court has any particular significant consequences in other aspects of judicial review in tax cases. Pat Smith has suggested that if the tax court is part of the executive branch, as the D.C. Circuit's opinion suggests, then the IRS could argue that the Administrative Procedure Act's judicial review provisions do not apply in tax court proceedings. So, for example, that might thereby free the IRS from having to defend itself against a hard look challenge under the arbitrary and capricious standard of the APA Section 706-2A and the Supreme Court's decision in the State Farm case, which requires agencies to provide a reasoned explanation for their decisions at the time the decision is made. Really, the interaction of tax law and the Administrative Procedure Act is a hugely open area right now because it's only been in the last few years that since the Supreme Court's decision in the Mayo case that we've seen tax lawyers and the tax agencies pay a whole lot of attention to the Administrative Procedure Act, with the result that now we're seeing a lot of creative and traditional administrative law arguments find their way, APA-based arguments, find their way into tax court jurisprudence. With all due respect to Pat, I'm doubtful that the courts are going to conclude that the D.C. Circuit's decision in Koretsky has any impact whatsoever on the applicability of the Administrative Procedure Act in judicial review of tax cases. I could be proven wrong in that regard as well. But if the Affordable Care Act penalty can be a tax for constitutional purposes, and yet not a tax under Section 7421A of the Internal Revenue Code, as the Supreme Court held in NFIB versus Sebelius, then I think the tax court can bear varying labels for different purposes as well. And reaching a conclusion that the tax court is a court of law for Appointments Clause purposes and an executive agency for removal purposes simply doesn't say anything about how the D.C. Circuit or any other court will treat the tax court for Administrative Procedure Act or other statutory purposes. And I think it was Chris Walker who pointed out to me that the D.C. Circuit's opinion in Koretsky seems to say as much when they cite an unpublished district court opinion for the proposition that because Congress labeled the tax court as a court for purposes of reviewing the actions of the IRS, that might mean that the tax court is a court of the United States rather than an agency under the Administrative Procedure Act and for Administrative Procedure Act purposes. So, in short, I think Koretsky is a really fun and fascinating separation of powers opinion that we academics can sit around and debate in terms of exactly what constitutes the executive power and what constitutes the judicial power. But I just don't expect very much to come of that other than academic analysis. And that's pretty much my thought with respect to the Koretsky opinion.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corgan again. We can now, if it's all right with both of you, we can open up the floor to questions from our callers.
Sure. Christian, if you wouldn't mind, I just had one quick substantive clarification or response in the nature of a clarification to Christian's comments.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I understand Christian's, or Professor Hickman's point about the idea that the traditional notion of malfeasance, inefficiency, neglect of duty as being a means of protecting an officer as against removal. One's brought to mind to Justice Scalia's colorful phrase in the Morrison versus Olson dissent in talking about the independent counsel, that one doesn't give for cause removal to the independent counsel as a means of locomotion for the president, but rather as a sort of shackles for the president. And so I think the important distinction, and I think the charitable interpretation to make Bauscher versus Sinar consistent with these others is the difference between the same power context versus the cross power context. And so what may operate as shackles within the same power context, such as independent regulatory agencies that are protected from the president with regard to malfeasance, inefficiency, neglect of duty, that can be distinguished from the cross-branch context where you have, for example, in the case of Bauscher versus Sinar, the controller general who's given certain functions that are executive, but then is subject to removal by Congress on grounds that are malfeasance, inefficiency, and neglect of duty. And it's in that context that the court indicates that that these grounds for removal are very broad and that they stand in for any number of actual or perceived transgressions. And so I think understood in that way, if we're talking about a cross-power removal rather than a same branch removal, another way to put it would be that power which is constitutionally required to be vested within the president for same branch removal purposes is different from that quantum of removal power that can taint the separation of powers in the cross-branch context.
If I can follow up, though, while I take that point entirely, I think it also begs the question about to what extent we really ought to think about the tax court as being in another branch. I realize it's established as an Article I court rather than, as opposed to being an Article III court. But, you know, again, this is sort of one of these situations where when we have these bodies in government, we try to put some label on them, but they don't fit neatly into any of the three traditional branches. Then, you know, it really begs the question, is this a cross-branch removal situation at all, or is it not? And I don't think that that's as clear-cut, you know, as you might make it out to be. I mean, on the one hand, I do look at Freytag, and then I look at the D.C. Circuit's reasoning in Koretsky, and I say, well, you know, there's a little bit of disingenuity here, you know, when you're talking about saying, well, that's for the appointment power, not for the removal power. But I don't think it's quite as clear-cut as you're suggesting that this is so obviously a cross-branch removal situation. And that's part of the difficulty, right?
But right, I made my comment mostly to just respond to the sort of
sure.
the scope of the removal power. Of course, my statement of it assumes the idea that there is a cross power removal. I think that that Freytag, if taken seriously, could be. I think the better reading of Freytag is that the court actually was saying that for constitutional functional purposes, that the tax court exercises the judicial power. Whether that was sort of the right conclusion as a matter of first principles, I'm on record as having been critical of that as a matter of first principles. But I don't know that that the Koretsky opinion's reading of Freytag bears close scrutiny.
I could respond, but I think it's best to open us up to questions at this point.
All right.
Or at least see if there are questions to open up to.
All right. Well, we'll give our audience a chance. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. And while we're waiting for our questions to get in line, just two quick programming notes. The first is that our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be tomorrow, July 18th at 2 p.m., brought to you by the Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau with our July 2014 update. And the second is also that there's still time to register for our 2014 annual Supreme Court Roundup for those of you here in Washington, D.C., which is at 12 o'clock tomorrow at the Mayflower Hotel. It looks like we've got two questions that jumped on the line, so we'll get right to them.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we should get back to basics and history as to what just the judicial power is. The judicial power is generally understood to be the power to issue enforceable judgments of a coercive nature. That is to say, not just declaratory, but injunctive or mandatory. So that raises the question then of if a executive is provided by the executive branch to the court, he at that point becomes under the control of the court, who may appoint him, remove him, or whatever, for him from a particular case. But even though the executive branch might be paying his salary, but similarly, if the executive branch decides to remove the administrator, if the court still has control of him, it may decide that it doesn't want to let go of him and demand that he complete the case before it really will release him. So an administrator functions, can function like a grand jury as a finder of fact or to administer resources, but it becomes judicial if it were to try to enforce coercive judgments. And for that, it would seem only by the separation of powers rule, only the Article III court should be allowed to do that. So how do we sort all this out and take things back to basics?
Well, I think in taking this back to basics, you're right that historically, in some sense, the judicial power has been the power to issue enforceable judgments. But administrative agencies often have that power as well. We have lots of agencies, executive branch agencies, for that matter, that have the power to adjudicate cases and issue self-executing orders that carry the force of law that may be appealable to an Article III court but don't have to be in order to be enforced. And we have no problem saying that what those agencies are exercising, I think Justice Scalia certainly would say that what those agencies are doing is exercising the executive power through an adjudicative model, it doesn't make them a court of law to exercise that sort of power. So, you know, that's part of the difficulty in administrative law and separation of powers generally, is trying to discern what is judicial power in an Article III sense versus what is the exercise of executive power through adjudicatory proceedings by executive branch officials. You know, and then for that matter, then how do you fit something like the tax court into that, which started out as an executive branch agency, then was shifted over into being an Article I court? You know, certainly, you know, this description of either the judicial power or the executive power doesn't seem like much in the vein of legislative power. What is an Article I court? You know, and that's really, that's part of the difficulty in this case, I think.
This is Professor Sam Ahad. I don't like the term Article I legislative court. I don't think that John Marshall's phrase adds much. I think what we usually mean when we say Article I legislative court is an adjudicator who lacks the attributes of tenure during good behavior and protection against salary diminution. Because, you know, Article III courts, at least the inferior Article III courts, are also created by legislative act under the Madisonian Compromise. The U.S. Courts of Appeals and inferior courts are all created when Congress decides to create them and to authorize them. And so I think that it's not a useful label to call someone an Article I, to call something an Article I legislative court if we don't really mean that it sort of exists, sort of to use the spatial metaphor, you know, within Article I. And if what we really mean is that that they're executive, then it's something of a misnomer to refer to them as legislative courts. I do understand Mr. Roland's concern, and I'm sympathetic to it, that there has to be some sort of substantive original understanding of what the word judicial meant, that it's not merely tautological wordplay that which seems to be what Justice Scalia contemplates, that whatever the executive branch does is executive, and that whatever Article III judges who have life tenure and salary protection do, that is judicial. I think that there's got to be some substantive import in each of the vesting clauses and in what the words legislative, executive, and judicial mean. And that's surely the difference between necessity and sufficiency in establishing what each of the powers is.
All right. Well, we've got one more question on the line to get to, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question of either or both of our experts, press star and then the pound key.
Hi, my name's Harry Lewis. I'm an attorney here in New York, and I have not read these opinions, so I'm at something of a disadvantage, but I did want to ask the panel whether any of the courts in these cases discussed the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Northern Pipeline Construction Company versus Marathon Pipeline Company, which is a 1982 decision, 458 U.S. 50, in which the court discussed the constitutionality of United States bankruptcy courts, which had been created by the Congress and which the court held violated Article III. Just referring to, I've got the excerpts from the Northern Pipeline decision in front of me, but the decision was written by Justice Brennan, and Justice Brennan basically analyzed the case as follows, and it seems to me it does have implications for the tax court as well. The first two categories of non-Article III courts that Brennan discussed were the territorial courts. He said permissible because Congress exercises the general powers of government in those territories, and permissible because the Constitution grants the political branches broad powers to control the military. The third exception Brennan discussed are tribunals for the adjudication of cases involving public rights, matters which arise, quote, between the government and persons subject to its authority in connection with the performance of the constitutional functions of the executive or legislative departments, which he contrasted with private rights, that is, disputes between two private parties, which are within the judicial power of Article III courts. So Brennan's big distinction in the Northern Pipeline case was between public rights versus private rights or disputes between two private parties. He held that, you know, in the context of the bankruptcy court, there was an adjudication of private rights between two private parties because it involved restructuring creditor-debtor relationships under the bankruptcy laws, and, you know, thereupon found that Congress's attempt to move the power from the Article III courts into these brand new bankruptcy courts was unconstitutional as a violation of Article III. But my question is this, was this distinction between public rights, which the tax court clearly would be adjudicating, because it's between government and persons subject to its authority, right, the tax laws, that would seem to clearly place the tax court within the Article I area, if you will, as an Article I court, and would seem to exclude tax controversies from the area that Brennan, characterized as within the judicial power of Article III courts. But can the panel tell me whether Northern Pipeline was even discussed in any of these cases, and whether this analysis, Brennan's analysis at that time, was in any way discussed or incorporated? Thanks.
Sure. Go ahead, Juan.
Sure. So Koretsky does address Northern Pipeline, and in that particular case, you're referring to the plurality opinion by Justice Brennan. And, the public rights category is the one that's the elastic category, territorial courts and courts martial being somewhat harder-edged categories than public rights. Just because something is a public right or falls within an exception doesn't necessarily mean, though, that Congress decides that it wants to give those over to non-Article III adjudicators not exercising the judicial power of the United States. They certainly could. That's within their discretion to assign those statutorily to those. But it could also assign bankruptcy matters, for example, to Article or tax matters. We could have an Article III tax court, and that would not violate anything that was said in Northern Pipeline. Your question, though, does raise the interesting question of, what are exactly bankruptcy judges? Are bankruptcy judges exercising a portion of the judicial power of the United States? I mean, under the 1984 BAFTA amendments to that was sort of the patch on the Northern Pipeline aftermath, the way that the court tried to fix the problem was to make bankruptcy courts adjunct to the Article III judiciary, by making sure that the non-Article III bankruptcy judges were dependent upon the Article III judges, and in many instances that may be the case. But we've now got the Stern v. Marshall problem that has been identified, that maybe they're not dependent enough or adjunct enough upon the Article III judiciary to avoid those problems. So Article III judges lack life tenure and salary protection, presumably, or bankruptcy judges lack life tenure and salary protection, so presumably they can't exercise the judicial power of the United States. And so, what branch are they? Are they now executive? Bankruptcy judges are removable by the U.S. Courts of Appeals, which is the same entity that appoints them. So that raises an interesting question.
Just to elaborate a little bit, too, since you specifically, Harry, were asking about the opinion itself, Tuan is absolutely right. The court does go into talking about this a little bit, just to give you a flavor of some of what the court has, the Koretsky court has to say about the issue. They describe these cases and the public rights category as comprising disputes that could be conclusively determined by the executive and legislative branches without judicial intervention. They say that the public rights doctrine reflects a pragmatic understanding that when Congress selects a quasi-judicial method of resolving matters that could be decided with no judicial review, the danger of encroaching on the judicial power is reduced. They acknowledge that the precise contours of the public rights doctrine are not fully formed, but they say it's really obvious, and they describe it as settled, that tax matters, at least at the pre-collection stage, fall within the category of private public rights, and therefore that it's not problematic at all for Congress to assign the adjudication of those disputes to a non-Article III tribunal like the tax court, and that's exactly what Congress did when it established the tax court as what the Koretsky court describes as an executive branch agency rather than as an Article III tribunal. So that's how the Koretsky court fits this particular case into the Northern Pipeline line of cases.
Thank you.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got two more questions that jumped on, so we'll get right to those and move on to the next one.
Yes, this is Bill Severson, Seattle. So I haven't read all the cases either, but it's just an absurd opinion in my view. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, and it's dangerously nonsensical. And in terms of allocation of power, I mean, you can't, you know, if it's judicial power, it's got to go to an Article III court. That's the whole idea of life tenure was set in as a matter of protection, and the idea of having public issues sort of insulated somehow from Article III review seems equally dangerous, although I suppose ultimately you've got to have Article III review of any of those enforcement actions against individual citizens, or at least I would hope so. But all this, we seem to be, as I hear Professor Hickman, seems to be accepting the ability of Congress to create these extra constitutional entities, sort of that don't fit into, you know, one of the boxes created in the Constitution. So we just manipulate the Constitution to try to justify the existence of these things. And that seems to me upside down, that what we should be doing is evaluating the constitutionality of the entities within the intent of the framers and judging it that way. It seems to me the tax court, you know, an executive, Congress can set up executive decision-making processes and provide for agency adjudications of that, and the tax court all makes sense within that context. But it doesn't make sense to kind of say that the tax court is this chameleon kind of entity that can be exercising judicial powers in an Article III kind of sense in some cases and not in other cases. That undermines, and then you can do that for anything. I mean, then the whole purpose of the Constitution is destroyed, I think. So I guess part of my question is it time to go back and kind of try and bring some sense by overruling Freitag, I guess.
Bill, I think you've hit the nail on the head in some sense. I think that there is no question in my mind that if the framers were to look at the existing government structure we have with administrative agencies, even leaving the tax court aside for the moment, just the existing agency structure that we have, I think that they'd be rather shocked and appalled. But there's an extent to which the horse is out of the barn on this one. However, my own personal proclivities might be to go back and adopt a more rigid and formalistic approach to separation of powers. I don't think the courts are likely to do that. They just seem, instead what they try to do is they try to take the existing structure that we have and figure out ways to describe what's going on in a way that allows that structure to continue while at the same time trying to draw some lines. I think I agree with you. I've always looked at Freytag and sort of, found the analysis of the tax court as either a court of law or a department with the chief judge as its head to be a little bit absurd, too. I look at Freytag and honestly, that's the part of the opinion that I take the least seriously. I sort of view that as a much more functionalist opinion that simply didn't want to decide that tax court special trial judges were improperly appointed and had no problem concluding that they were inferior officers based on what they did, but then had to try to figure out how to shoehorn their appointment by the chief judge of the tax court, who's the most reasonable person to appoint them, into the appointments clause. So we end up with this somewhat absurd argument about whether they're a court of law or whether they're a head of a department when they don't really fit easily into either box. You could make that same argument with respect to any adjudicatory body that is in the executive branch or that we label as being an Article I court. Since the Supreme Court doesn't seem inclined to try to put that horse back into the barn, then we find ourselves in these arguments over exactly what the tax court represents from a separation of powers perspective. And, the analysis isn't all that consistent. I don't think the Supreme Court's analysis of either the appointments power or the removal power has been all that consistent over the last 100 years. But there we are.
I just have no control. Professor Hickman, this is Christian Corrigan. I think we had some technical difficulties, so part of your last answer ended up getting cut off, I think, the last 30 to 45 seconds. I'm not sure, definitely on my end, I'm not sure for the rest of our callers, but so we apologize for that.
No worries.
Professor Samahan, are you still on?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, great. Do you have anything else that you want to add before we move to the next question?
The next question would be fine. I think Professor Hickman addressed the last one.
Greetings. My name's Steve McCloskey from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And, your panel really knows their stuff. My compliments. And first, let me preface by apologizing for I'm going to ask a very naive question, and I hope you don't mind. But it was the separation of powers issues that caught my attention rather than the tax aspect. And my question is this. Here's the naivete. Can the tax courts sentence people who appear before them criminally? Can they impose criminal sanctions against them? And if they can, would that not argue in favor of an Article III court, since Congress would presumably determine the sentence structure for those courts? Conversely, if they can only impose civil penalties, fines, for example, would that not argue in favor of an Article I type court? Thank you again.
Juan, do you want to take this one, or you?
Yeah.
Want
so, 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 to my knowledge, there's no criminal jurisdiction, and they'd have to be in an Article III court with regard to civil penalties. Absolutely, they can assess civil penalties. I think, though, that doesn't mean that it must be a non-Article III court. We do have Article 3 courts that hear entirely civil matters only and that are nonetheless Article 3 courts. I'm thinking of the U.S. Court of International Trade, for example, as a specialty Article 3 court. Correct me if I'm wrong, Professor Hickman.
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I'm not sure whether I'll take your word for it that the Court of International Trade is Article 3 as opposed to Article 1. I always forget about that. You know, I always forget which one it is. But just
it's
to clarify
doctors.
A little bit for other people on the call who aren't so familiar with the tax court, the tax court is a court of limited jurisdiction. The only cases the tax court hears arise when the IRS has assessed a deficiency against the taxpayer for not paying enough in taxes, and then the taxpayer has the choice of going to tax court without first paying the tax, or instead paying the tax and suing for a refund by going to either the Court of Federal Claims or the United States District Court. So really, the taxpayers who go to the tax court are opting into that court. I mean, now sometimes as a practical matter, you know, nobody wants to pay the tax if they don't have to. And a lot of people don't have the capacity to pay the tax that the IRS has assessed. So a lot of taxpayers, you know, probably feel like they're compelled to go into tax court. But as a purely legal matter, it's a choice whether they do or not. They opt into the tax court by choosing to take their deficiency actions there. And the tax court does have the power to uphold the penalties that the IRS assesses for failure to pay the amount of taxes that you have been assessed. But that's basically the limited scope of the tax court's ability to, for that matter, assess penalties. And that's purely civil. Criminal tax cases don't go to tax court at all.
Thank you very much, Professors.
I might note additionally that if you are a taxpayer with limited means such that you're not able to pay the alleged tax deficiency, the U.S. Tax Court might really be the only forum for you to realistically bring a challenge, because otherwise the Article 3 forum is unavailable. So in terms of prepayment,
you're absolutely right.
There's a sense in which poor taxpayers or taxpayers are just simply unable to pay get a different form of justice than Article 3 courts might afford. And I might just finally add that you know, regardless of what constitutional principles might compel or require as a result, I think there's probably agreement on the fact that if tomorrow Congress decided that it wanted to create an Article III court, a U.S. tax court, that was to serve as a bulwark for the taxpayer against the IRS, judges with tenure during good behavior and salary protection, it could do so.
I think that's absolutely right. And you're absolutely right about the practicality of it all. Something like 90% of tax cases go to the tax court rather than to the Court of Federal Claims or a federal district court, largely because you don't have to pay the tax. And for a lot of people, trying to pay the tax would at least be difficult, if not absolutely prohibitive. So for a lot of taxpayers, tax court as a practical matter really is the only way that they can go. The question then becomes to what extent that practical aspect then ends up influencing the constitutional analysis. And it's not at all clear to me that the courts take that practical aspect into account in evaluating constitutional questions in conjunction with the tax court.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got at least one more question on the line and about 5 minutes to go, so we'll make this our last question and to finish out the call.
This is Warren Belmar in Florida calling. Very interesting and very illuminating discussion. I've been very impressed with not only the comments but the questions from the floor as well. Mine isn't as impressive, but it just struck me as to mention of the Court of Federal Claims, and I was wondering if there was any discussion or idea as to the implications of the decisions on the operation of the Court of Federal Claims.
If I may, this is Professor Samahan. I think this is an interesting point that you raise. So the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, at least under the rationale and logic of Kuretsky, is a part then of the executive branch, that it decides cases in a quasi-judicial mode, but that it's actually exercising executive power. So interestingly, the judges of the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, they are subject to removal not by the president, but by statute, they are subject to removal by judges in the Article III judiciary. So the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has the power to remove those judges. And so although Kuretsky might have dodged the issue with regard to the U.S. Tax Court, it has now created a problem with regard to the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, where there is now a cross-power removal with judges able to remove officers who exercise only the executive power of the United States.
I suppose the D.C. Circuit thinks that's the Federal Circuit's problem.
Well, we did have one more caller jump on the line, one more question, and we've got about 4 minutes. So if neither of you mind, we'll go ahead and try to get to that before we finish.
Totally fine.
Great.
Professors, I'm embarrassed that I don't remember the names of each of you, but the lady professor talked about some reservations she had about the Supreme Court's analysis of certain constitutional aspects of tax law and so forth. And I noticed in the Kuretsky decision that the court addressed Murray's lessee versus Hoboken Land and Improvement Company. And in looking at the government's briefs, they elaborated quite a bit with Murray's lessee. And I've searched, I suppose, about every tax case from the beginning of our country to the present, and I've never seen any court or any attorney that I'm aware of address the rights that Murray's lessee talks about for individual taxpayers, specifically the Due Process Clause, which Justice Benjamin R. Curtis addressed in his decision. And he talks about the fact that, and the Supreme and the United States brief talks about the fact that our tax procedures are adopted from the old English exchequer processes and those processes that are used by the states under the Articles of Confederation. Have any of you done or attempted to do any kind of research into what rights the individual taxpayer has vis-a-vis the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment as to tax procedures that are used today by the Commissioner and through the Internal Revenue Manual and the Martinsburg Enterprise Computing Center and that sort of thing? Have any of you done any analysis of that, or are any of you open to doing any of that?
This is Professor Samahan. I'll note that one of my co-counsel, John Michonne, prepared an issue that was in the brief that concerned a due process objection that was unfortunately also rejected by the court. It concerned a violation of the taxpayer's due process. In the context of the notice of the IRS's proposed levy, I've not comprehensively looked at the particular issue, but that was one of the issues that was briefed in the case, and the idea that the IRS has to afford a taxpayer some manner of hearing before imposing a levy.
I also don't spend my research tends to focus more on the rulemaking side of what the IRS and Treasury do than the adjudication side. But at the same time, I know that there are people out there who do evaluate various things that Treasury, the IRS, or not Treasury, but the IRS and the tax court do in due process terms. I can't point you to a particular article, and I can't necessarily tell you that any of them talk about Murray's lessee, but you know, I can definitely say that some people have focused quite a bit on the due process aspects of IRS adjudications in tax court review. Just not me.
I'm trying to remember. I'm sorry, because I'm not a tax guy. I'm a constitutional law guy. The taxpayer advocate has written an article. It was one of the Irwin Griswold lectures.
Nina Olson.
Nina Olson has an article on due process in the tax court. And I think, interestingly, too, a lot of the separation of powers concerns can be couched in terms or understood in terms of due process. And one concern, of course, is this line of cases that recognizes the idea that the executive branch can afford due process, that that it doesn't have to be due process of law from a court, but it could be due process from an executive branch. And you can see this in other contexts where, for example, the president claims authority to kill U.S. citizens using drone strikes without any conviction. And in that particular context, there's a notion of the executive branch providing, in its own highly secretive sort of way, due process for those individuals rather than an adjudicative due process provided in the judicial branch.
Well, this is Christian Corgan, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Professors Hickman and Samahan for joining us today for a very exciting discussion, and thank you for our audience for asking such great and intriguing questions. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please do join us tomorrow for our next scheduled call at 2 p.m. Eastern for an update on the CFPB. And also, if you can, if you're in D.C., join us for our annual Supreme Court roundup tomorrow at noon at the Mayflower Hotel. So until then, we're adjourned, and a thank you to both our experts in the audience. So until then, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.